Welcome to the Radio Times Regional Roundup. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Ahead this hour, Pennsylvania's counties are attempting to upgrade or buy new voting machines ahead of the 2020 presidential election, which could end up costing well over $100 million. However, Governor Wolf and the legislature haven't been able to agree on funding. Also, Atlantic City's Mid-Merloche Pipe Organ is a musical treasure whose home lies within the walls of Boardwalk Hall. The organ happens to be the world's largest musical instrument and is beloved by many, but it needs a lot of work to fully restore its magnificent sound. But first, remember the heat wave of a couple of weekends ago, in which temperatures soared to nearly 100 degrees each day? Imagine experiencing that heat wave and then some by adding 5, even 8 degrees to the already stifling temperatures. This is the reality for a number of neighborhoods in Philadelphia whose residents are often poor and of color and without the means to leave or otherwise seek relief. Well, the city is stepping in and, with the impact of climate change in mind, is developing a plan to help provide respite, beginning with one of the neighborhoods hardest hit, and that is Hunting Park. The city's Office of Sustainability is leading the effort, and here with us now is Director Christine Knapp. Well, welcome, Christine, to Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
And before we begin, I'd like to give out our email address, radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. So, Christine, tell us about Hunting Park and why it is often so much hotter there than other areas of the city.
Yeah, that is the most common question we get when we look at the map that we've provided of the city. You can see that some areas of the city can be as much as 22 degrees hotter than other areas, which is sort of an astounding difference. And so we really have looked at those areas that are hotter than average and tried to understand what's going on there. Hunting Park is one of those. Strawberry Mansion, parts of Point Breeze, parts of West Philadelphia around the Cobbs area are all areas that are hotter than average. One of the things, as you mentioned in your introduction, is that most of these areas are predominantly low income and they're predominantly either African American or Latinx neighborhoods. So that is certainly a factor to consider, the city's sort of racial history of redlining, of disinvestment in communities of color, certainly plays some role, I would say, in this outcome that we've got. Looking at tree canopy, you can definitely see a correlation there. Lower tree canopy, obviously, in these hotter areas. Less green space, less access to cooling areas like that.
A lot of asphalt.
A lot of asphalt, a lot of industry, a lot of paved surfaces,
blacktop roofs.
Yeah. Exactly. Yeah. So you have the lack of sort of helpful things and an increase in harmful things in these communities that are really sort of leading to this circumstance.
So your office set up a Beat the Heat team, which went out to actually talk to people who live in the Hunting Park area. What did they tell you?
Yeah, they told us a lot, I should say.
Sure they did.
This was a partnership with lots of city agencies. I should not take full credit. The Health Department, Office of Emergency Management, Water Department, Parks and Rec, lots of other departments worked with us on this. But yeah, we wanted to hear directly from residents. How do you experience heat? What is it? What do you do? So, you know, what would help you cope with it? And then what would you like to see happen in the long term to make it less hot? We surveyed about 530 residents through formal surveys. We had hundreds of others that we talked to through focus groups or just informal chats at different events that we held. We learned a lot of things. One is that people tended to stay home during heat waves, but they still felt too hot at home.
Did many have access to air conditioning or at least a window unit?
Yeah, there was a surprising number that said they did have air conditioning, but a lot of them didn't use air conditioning because they were afraid of high energy bills.
Yeah.
And so that's certainly an area of recommendation that we have is to improve people's understanding of and access to both weatherization programs that could help, you know, make it tighter in their home so they're not spending as much on their electricity bills, but also access to low-income energy assistance programs that our utilities offer so that people don't have to be quite as afraid of using the cooling resource that they do have. We found low familiarity with those programs and even lower familiarity with people who spoke Spanish in Hunting Park. So we know that's an area for improvement.
So what is the city doing then to improve access to these programs and improve knowledge of these programs?
Yeah, so that's the next phase of this is, you know, kind of taking the information and now putting together a plan. So we've already spoken with our partners over at PECO. We'll be speaking with the other utilities to sort of understand how do you do outreach in this community? Can we sort of come up with better ways to work with you to get that information? In Hunting Park, another sort of finding we found was that people got their information primarily from other neighbors. It wasn't the news. It wasn't the paper. It wasn't social media. It was each other. And so, you know, understanding how social networks work is a fascinating study, but really thinking about if there's a block captain or other community leaders who are sources and hubs for information, how can we make sure that they have information around these programs to help spread out?
So is there a safety net in place for those who might be most vulnerable during extreme weather, the elderly, the sick?
Yeah, the city has been partnering with the Philadelphia Corporation for Aging for years on a heat hotline that is activated during high heat events that are declared. And folks can call that number and they can talk to a registered nurse, I believe, a health professional. They can give them advice over the phone. If they feel like they need it, they can actually go visit that home, which has been, great resource for helping those who are most vulnerable.
Is there some respite readily available right now, say in the Hunting Park neighborhood? And I'm thinking of the park itself.
Yes.
It's at least 80 acres. And when you were talking about temperature disparities, like Hunting Park could be 22 degrees, warmer than the coolest spot, I imagine, in the
right.
city, which is probably a really nice, shady area.
Yeah, exactly.
Is Hunting Park something that is realistically a good place to go and try to beat the heat?
Yeah, the park itself is definitely a great cooling resource. And within the park is the pool, which is one of the most used pools in the whole city. So we know those are both great cooling resources for the community. Some of the problems, not everybody wants to go to a pool, right? Not all seniors are sort of throw on a suit and
sure.
go jump in the pool. So it's not really accessible for everybody. But even also getting to the park can be a barrier for folks. So the plan that we have here does provide some feedback and recommendations from the residents about how to sort of facilitate their transportation options to get into the park. I think when we talk about the greening section of recommendations, we also want to extend the benefit of the park outside of the neighborhood. So kind of, if the more trees that kind of come out of the park and onto the street trees can kind of almost create like cool corridors that are coming off the park. So we definitely think there's a way to take that asset and grow it. The downside in terms of cooling resources in the community is that there's not a formal, what the city would call a cooling center. So when there's a declared emergency, the city activates mostly libraries to serve as sort of cooling centers. They stay open later. There is not one of those formal centers in Hunting Park, yeah. but residents did express interest in having something like that in a more informal way. Yeah. So right now we're working with some of the faith institutions in Hunting Park to see if they would be willing to sort of serve as that in an informal capacity, that they would just open their doors, have some board games, have some snacks, and invite people in to cool down.
Also, one of the issues, especially with climate change, is that the nights are actually growing warmer. They don't cool off as much as they did. You have temperatures in the 80s and Hunting Park and maybe some of the cooling centers. Well, that might be great for during the day, but how do you help residents get through the night?
Yeah, and so we have sort of our recommendations bucketed into three areas, and the first one is staying cool at home, because we know we do want to provide people opportunities to get outside of the home, but ultimately they do have to come home and go to bed, and we need to make sure that they are able to do that comfortably. I mentioned earlier energy programs. One program we identified as a sort of area for reform is LIHEAP, which a lot of folks are familiar with for heating bills support. PECO has told us that there's about $30 million a year that goes unspent in LIHEAP funding that the state receives. As we look at our future, we're going to have hotter summers and cooler or warmer winters, so we'll probably need a little less of that funding in the winter, but we probably will need it more in the summer. So we want to explore whether we can use LIHEAP year-round for both heating and cooling, especially since there are unspent dollars there to be used for that purpose.
We are speaking with Christine Knapp, who is Sustainability Director for the City of Philadelphia. We have an email from Matt who says, the small relief found when walking in shaded parks and streets is quite noticeable, yet our current city planning does nothing to incentivize real low-maintenance green spaces. In fact, it arguably encourages the opposite. What do you think?
Well, I think we're trying to turn the corner on that. I think some of our city programs, like the Water Department's Green City Clean Waters program is really incentivizing green infrastructure everywhere in the city, whether that's plants, planted rain gardens, or trees. So I think there's really strong incentives because they have a sort of federal mandate to do that. And they're a partner on this project as well, and looking to install some in Hunting Park. But on the trees front, I know that's been sort of trees in Philadelphia always have like a long storied history of people's feelings about them. The Parks and Recreation Department is actually undergoing sort of an urban forest plan right now, and looking at some of its policies that have potentially inhibited some neighborhoods from having trees. So home ownership requirement has certainly had some impact. And is there a way to get around that? Maintenance is, we know, a concern. So what are some of the maintenance strategies that we can apply as a city so that folks who want a tree but don't want to take on all that maintenance can still feel comfortable getting one? So those are all under review right now through this urban forest plan.
What about something as simple as painting roofs white? Mm-hmm. How much of a difference does that make
on
summer's day?
That does make a difference. At least up to about 8 degrees, I think, is the upper end of the impact on that.
That's
usually
huge.
2 or 3. Yeah. So depending on the neighborhood, the more roofs that are done in an area, the greater the benefit. So just one white roof in a sea of black roofs isn't going to have as much of an impact. It is actually city law that if you are replacing your roof, that it needs to be reflective or white roofed. That's part of what we see in neighborhoods like Hunting Park that haven't had as much investment, haven't had as much development going on. We have a sort of screenshot in the report of the difference between an aerial view of the Fairmount neighborhood and the Hunting Park neighborhood, and you can see the differences of the number of white roofs versus black roofs in those communities.
Is it expensive?
It is not actually that expensive, and it does actually increase the length of the life of the roof, so it is actually a good investment. But again, if you're talking about low-income homes,
yes,
there's lots of other needs in that home. The roof may not be in good enough condition to even have someone go walk on it to put that white coating down. So it's easy to say to do, but it's much harder to carry out.
So in the meantime, the city is looking to create a heat relief network for Hunting Park, which mm-hmm. might actually be used as a template for other neighborhoods, because Hunting Park's not the only heat island neighborhood.
Right.
What might be included in overall in a heat relief network as we wrap up this segment?
Sure. Yes. Yeah, so as I mentioned, we think faith institutions would be an amazing partner. They usually have spaces that are underutilized during the week, during non-service times. Many of them have air conditioning. So they want to serve the communities that they're in. And so we think that's a great partnership. But I can imagine even extending that to other spaces. We know indoor malls are often, or movie theaters, bookstores, coffee shops. These are all sort of public, you know, sort of public spaces that can be made to be part of that network if they want it to be. And so that's something we want to explore further, is how can we promote that to folks? If, you know, if it's a 8-block walk from your house to the pool and you really want to go there, can you find, you know, one or two spots along that route to stop into and sit down for a minute and cool off to make that possible for you?
So, Christine, as the summer, we've got, I guess, another good month of summer ahead of us. If somebody from, say, Hunting Park is listening to this program right now, what would you advise them to do immediately if they're looking for advice as to stay cooler during the rest of the summer?
Yeah, I have to say the first thing would be to look into those energy improvement programs at home, because, we know people have to be in their home at some point. They can't get out all the time. So go look at PECO particular and look at their programs that they offer for weatherization and also for the low-income assistance program, so that you can run your air conditioner at home. If you don't have an air conditioner, there's other ways to stay cool. Use fans, open your windows, wear what light color clothing, drink lots of water.
Christine Knapp, Sustainability Director for the City of Philadelphia, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Coming right up, we'll hear about the political battle over updating Pennsylvania's voting machines. Stay with us. This is Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
You are listening to Radio Times. I'm Harry Cummings Jordan. Welcome back. Voting machines in Pennsylvania will need to be able to produce a paper trail in time for the 2020 presidential election in an effort to tighten security following Russian interference in the 2016 election, a state mandate which takes on heightened urgency following a finding by the Senate Intelligence Committee Thursday that the U.S. remains vulnerable to Russian interference. Of course, overhauling or buying new machines costs money. It's estimated over $100 million, and Democratic Governor Wolf and Republican lawmakers have been tangling over how much funding to provide to counties to help foot the bill. Also, new questions are being raised on hidden costs that might hit the taxpayer down the road when machines are in need of upgrades. If you'd like to send along a question or comment, our email is radiotimes@whyy.org, or you can tweet us at @WHYYRadioTimes. Joining us from the studios of WITF in Harrisburg with the latest on this story, Emily Previty is a reporter for Keystone Crossroads and PA Post. Hi, Emily.
Good morning.
And Katie Meyer is Harrisburg Bureau Chief for WHYY and WITF. Hi, Katie.
Hello.
So let's go back a few years to begin. Remind us how the mandate first came about with the Jill Stein campaign. And Stein was the Green Party candidate, presidential candidate for 2016. Katie?
Sure. So after the 2016 election, Jill Stein sued Pennsylvania. She said that because our voting systems were difficult to double check because many of them were electronic, they didn't have paper ballots and they didn't have paper receipts for voters. So it made it harder to make sure that the vote had been counted correctly. And so Pennsylvania settled that lawsuit. They said, okay, we will, in exchange for, you know, dropping the suit, we're going to upgrade all of our voting machines to ones that have what's called voter verifiable paper ballots by the 2020 election. And so Governor Wolf had, you know, said that before the settlement happened, and then the settlement really solidified this as a commitment. And of course, not everybody was on board with this. The counties were a little bit annoyed, I think, to put it lightly, that the governor had given them this mandate and the funding on the state level, at the very least, wasn't totally clear.
Hmm. And Katie or Emily, was there evidence of election tampering in Pennsylvania in 2016?
No, the lawsuit was filed over election system vulnerabilities in Pennsylvania and also in Michigan and Wisconsin.
Tell us about what Governor Wolf was originally looking for in the way of funding this and what the legislature offered. Katie Meyer?
Sure. So the governor had a couple different proposals, but the one that was part of the budget this year, he had asked for about $60 million for these upgrades. And, you know, this had all been, you know, part and parcel of a much larger budget package. So what ended up happening was there was, you know, what's called horse trading about it. People went back and forth on what they were willing to give the governor. We have a Republican-controlled House and Senate.
Sure.
So anything that, you know, is a big priority of Wolf's, they have some power to manipulate it a little bit, get what they want in it. So what ended up happening with that was they gave him a $90 million bill. And that's great. That's more than he asked for. But they put into that bill a component that would have gotten rid of automatic straight ticket voting. And that's something that Democrats like. It's for people who know that, for instance, they're going to vote a straight Democratic ticket. They can just press that button and get out of the voting booth quickly. Democrats argue this, you know, increases voter turnout because it gives people a kind of easy option if they know the party they want to vote for. Mm-hmm. And it makes voting quicker. So if there's long lines for a general election, for instance, it really gets that line moving and it can save people from having to wait all day if they have to go to work or something.
Why wouldn't Republicans not like that as well?
They argue that it's something that, you know, makes people less informed voters. They say, well, if you're just voting for a party, it's not like you're voting for candidates. Maybe you don't know enough. Democrats say, you know, we can't dictate what people know. We just want to give them this option. So that's kind of the back and forth. And we saw a lot of debate on the House and Senate floors about this. But ultimately, that component did get put into the bill. And so Wolf vetoed the entire thing, which means he also vetoed the funding component.
Okay. So Governor Wolf is now proposing that a bond is issued through the state's Economic Development Financing Authority. I think, Emily, you said this is known as PEDFA?
Correct.
Is this a realistic way to get the money?
Well, that's a good question. Wolf certainly thinks so. He, when we asked him, we had a a little press conference, and he said, "Well, I'm not a lawyer, but people have assured me that this is legitimate and it'll work." It comes down to how people interpret the language. Wolf says it's supposed to be interpreted broadly, which would mean that they don't need approval from the General Assembly to issue the bond through this agency. Republicans say absolutely not. Like, we do need legislative approval for something like this. If Wolf had thought he was allowed to do this, he wouldn't have gone to the legislature in the first place. He would have just done it. So they are, pretty angry about this. They had some very strong statements about how he was undermining democracy. And they say they're still exploring their legal options.
Mm. Republicans, actually, they're pointing to the state constitution, aren't they?
They are, yes. Stan Saylor, he's the chair of the House Appropriations Committee, a Republican. He said that the move undermines the fabric of our constitutional democracy, and it risks the good relationship Wolf had cultivated with the General Assembly over the last couple of months. So Saylor was pitching this as something, Wolf had worked with them on the voting machine issue. He had worked with them on the budget, but now this was a big problem. And to be fair, often when there are conflicts, people will toss out language like this and say, well, now you've, screwed up and now we're mad at you. So we'll see where it goes.
So Katie and also Emily Previty, in watching the budget negotiations and even the relationship between Governor Wolf and Republican legislative leaders over the past few months and even years, would you describe the relationship, at least recently, as good? From an observer's perspective, how would you characterize that relationship?
Well, I think it's always going to be a sort of tense relationship because, again, the governor is a Democrat and the House and Senate are run by Republicans. But I will say, Wolf's first budget year, for instance, we saw him get himself into a huge quagmire, for lack of a better word, because he tried to do broad-based tax increases. An increase in the in various wide-ranging taxes. And so now Wolf has very, very much pulled back on those big proposals for an income tax, for a sales tax, and he has tried to just avoid any of those impasses. And what that means is that he is sort of, ceding some ground to the Republicans because he's not asking for those things anymore. Yeah. So he's playing their game a little bit more, which has led them to say the relationship is much better because, of course, they love it when he does that. But it's never going to be, a totally kumbaya situation.
Well, so and back to the voting machines, we have, just over a year till the 2020 presidential election, still no funding in place to help counties either replace systems or upgrade systems. Counties do have to pick up a chunk of the tab. Do we know if county commissioners have been pushing back vigorously against any of this? I mean, do counties in general have the funds to pay their share?
So there were no counties that said this is going to totally wipe us out. Many of them had contingency plans for paying for these upgrades and replacements absent of state funding. Using leftover bond proceeds was an answer I received in a few cases. Some had been looking at replacing their machines because they were 20 or 30 years old anyway. And so they had been saving for that and planning for that absent, again, state funding and the state mandate. So no, they're not happy. It would make their lives easier if they did. The more money they get back from the state, the better. But most of them seem to have contingency plans, and it doesn't appear that this is going to be of such a high cost in any one county that, as I said, it totally wipes them out or pushes them into bankruptcy or forces major budget cuts.
So it seems
this is also this.
Go ahead.
I'm sorry. This is giving them the money back, so they don't need it
right up
front.
Okay.
So they were going to pay for it anyway. They just want to know where it's going to come from and when it's going to get there.
Yeah. Okay. And again, back to some of the counties already have machines which can produce a paper trail in place. These counties were pushing back. And does Wolf have a plan for these particular counties separately?
He's given them a 1-year extension.
Mm-hmm. To upgrade?
2021. Correct. Yeah.
Okay. But they will be using paper ballots or at least a paper trail in time for the 2020 presidential election. Okay. And one more question before we move on to another part of this subject. According to the state, voting machines must also meet 21st century standards of accessibility. Is there a real issue across the state regarding accessibility and disabled voters across Pennsylvania?
The only one that I'm aware of that has been brought to our attention comes up in the petition that was filed recently with the Department of State to reconsider certification of the Express Votes XL. Mm-hmm. There are issues with the machine's ability to allow hearing impaired voters to verify their ballots, for example. So basically, you know, the audio format of the ballot prior to being cast. So that has come up with one machine, and that's among multiple concerns laid out in the petition that I mentioned.
Yeah. Oh, and actually, Emily Previty, this brings us to an email from Simon, who says, as a blind voter, I am able to vote independently on the current non-paper voting system in Philadelphia. Will the upgrades impact my ability to vote independently? I'm not sure if you have that information at your fingertips, but what are your thoughts?
Well, we know what the law says, right? The counties are under an obligation to accommodate all voters so that they can cast their ballots, you know, with anonymity like everyone else.
Mm. And back to the Express Vote XL, which is the machine that Philadelphia County and some other counties have proposed implementing in time for 2020. The creator of the Express Vote XL is a vendor called Election Systems and Software, ES&S, which I believe is a vendor for a great many counties across Pennsylvania. What are they saying regarding questions about security in the Express Vote XL? Have they been vocal, Emily Previty?
About security?
And about questions about the security. Are they disputing the security issue?
It's not, no, I wouldn't say, I mean, if you're talking about security from like vote tampering, that hasn't, I mean, to the extent that there are concerns about the anonymity of ballots being cast, if you detect a mistake on your ballot, for example, there are mm-hmm. concerns about that. There are concerns, like we said, with the audio format of the ballot as far as getting that verified prior to the final casting of it. But as far as it being more susceptible necessarily to some kind of external tampering, no, not in the way that you're asking.
Okay. Another wrinkle, Emily Previty, counties might also need to consider money in the future for upgrades. For instance, some of the machines that are being considered rely on Windows 7. Which will expire soon, correct?
Right. So Windows 7 sunsets next year, which means that Windows will not be sending supports, including patches, to address any security issues that might come to the company's attention. Windows has since said that they'll provide extended support through 2023, but that's still a year or two before most of these agreements between counties and voting companies expire. So.
There's a state program named CoStars, which has been made available to counties. Tell us about this and how it might help counties as they possibly grapple with expenses down the road regarding upgrades.
So CoStars is the state's bulk purchasing program that's run through the Department of General Service, and basically the state negotiates a contract on behalf of its members, so counties, local governments, municipal authorities. You just have to register and be considered a public purchasing entity. And this particular contract does attempt to limit some future upgrade costs. There's language in there requiring vendors to build potential costs for upgrades and updates and security patches for software and firmware. They have to build that into pricing in these initial 5-year term of these agreements. And that language seemed very clear to me.
Mm-hmm. So even with that language, not all counties are bidding through CoStars. Have they said why?
So some counties say that they aren't bidding through CoStars because their experience has been in the past that they were able to get a better deal, for example, in going out on their own. For example, in Columbia County, they're planning to not go through CoStars. They say they've had success in the past by bidding companies off of one another, and they're planning to do that again. We'll see what happens there. They're in the final stages of selecting their voting machine vendor. They were down to three, now they're down to two, and we're planning on following that process to sort of tell the story to our audience through that lens of one county.
Has there been an overall dollar amount estimated associated with future costs for upgrades? I mean, that's all kind of hanging out in the air, but it's a topic that has been researched. Has anybody mentioned a figure to you, whether it's $1 million, $10 million, or et cetera, down the road?
Emily? No. We know that it costs between $60,000 and $80,000 to go through the Pennsylvania Department of State certification process, and it's about $1 million to go through the Federal Election Assistance Commission, or EAC, certification. Those costs don't fully encompass research and development expenses. Certifications wouldn't necessarily be required for every single update either. We did ask county officials just to give us a range. Why was this concerning? Why was this a sticking point for some of them? What were their concerns or expectations for exposure? York, for example, was one. And they couldn't estimate the cost. I even said, I'm guessing it's not hundreds of dollars because then you wouldn't have cared so much.
Sure.
I'm guessing it's not millions because then the voting machine companies wouldn't have even, consented to considering this. And their response was, yeah, we don't know.
But ultimately, it is the taxpayer who picks up the tab, right? Or at least part of it.
Yes.
In one way or another.
Yeah, in one way or the other, exactly. So, and it could be, and that's why we mean by risk, because there are scenarios, as we've said, that some companies have committed very clearly in writing to picking up the tab, as you put it, in some but not all cases. Other companies say, our general policy is to cover this, but then it's unclear what type of situations, even when we ask them, wouldn't fall into that, quote, typical or general policy.
Mm. Another thing that could push up costs for counties, there needs to be government approval or certification of voting machines for official use. How much are we talking about here?
So the Pennsylvania Department of State certification process costs between $60,000 and $80,000. And the federal EAC, that's $1 million approximately. And one of the conditions of certification in Pennsylvania is that you have to have the EAC certification as well. But again, not every single update, upgrade, or patch is going to require going back through certification.
An important story, but it's tough to get your arms around it. Or a challenge. So back to you, Katie Meyer.
Sure.
Just looking ahead, what's next as far as you see it in the effort to get the state funding to help counties out with the upgrades?
So that's the $1 million question. Well, much more than $1 million question.
$100 million question.
Somewhere around there. They're going to be back in session in September, and we're expecting to get a better sense of what the Republicans plan to do then. So there's going to be two prongs of this. We're going to see Wolf moving forward with his efforts to issue this bond. We're going to see exactly, what kind of criteria this agency needs. And then we're going to see on the Republican side if they do come up with a lawsuit to try to intervene in Wolf's process here, if they come up with a good legal reason why he cannot do this. Because, again, this comes down to a difference in interpretation.
Yeah.
So we'll
and
see.
Election security. Katie Meyer, thank you so much. State Capitol Bureau Chief for WHYY. We appreciate you coming along. Emily Previty is reporter for Keystone Crossroads and PA Post. We appreciate it. Stay with us here.
Thanks
at Radio
so much.
Times.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Hidden within the walls of Atlantic City's Boardwalk Hall is the world's largest musical instrument. Built during the Great Depression, the magnificent Mid-Merloche pipe organ was in later years all but abandoned to age and deterioration. But thanks to the devoted attention of a band of music aficionados, the organ is slowly, painstakingly, and lovingly being restored. It is breathtaking when you see it up close, and its sound is incredible in person. People from around the world come to Boardwalk Hall to visit. So to finish the hour, we're going to introduce this instrument to those of us who aren't familiar with it, and we'll hear about how the restoration effort is going. Nathan Bryson is curator of pipe organs for the Historic Organ Restoration Committee, and he joins us in studio. Thanks for making the trip in.
Absolutely. My pleasure to be here.
So the music piece we heard coming into the segment was, what, Thunder and Blazes?
Thunder and Blazes, yes, ma'am.
And played by whom? It's Scott Brainer?
Oh, organist Scott Brainer, yes. He lives in Ocean City, and he's one of our many organists. We actually have 19 different organists playing on our summer recital series this summer.
And this, what we heard, was the organ restored to 50%?
Approximately 50%.
That's it.
That's it, yes. I tell people we have 449 ranks, or you could equate that to a 449-voice symphony orchestra. Of those, right now, we have 238 ranks playing, we just calculated, so approximately 53%. So I say that part of our orchestra is still out, that we're bringing them slowly back together.
So, I mean, it begs the question, what is it going to sound like when it's at 100%?
I can't wait. There are so few people that are honestly still alive today that heard it at its peak. Mm. We know that the vast majority of the instrument played for the 1964 Democratic National Convention. But after that, many of the parts of the instrument had to be slowly taken offline. The city employed a curator up through, I believe, the late 1990s, actually. But unfortunately, they really gave him very little budget at all to work with. So he actually had to take parts from literally from the instrument itself just to keep a small portion playing.
Yeah. Well, let's first talk about what you see when you visit Boardwalk Hall. 7 years ago, I did a story on the Mid-Merloge for WHYY. I opened the report by saying that when you walk into the hall, it almost feels as if the walls contain a living presence. I might be off the wall here. It's hard to say why I felt this, but can you relate to this?
Or absolutely.
Because you can't see the organ, but
there's... You can't see it, but you just kind of, you feel that there's something more when you walk into that building. It's such a beautiful and really extraordinary space. But you're exactly right. When you walk in and you just look around, you just get the sense that there's something more.
Yeah. Well, behind the walls lies... What? Describe a little bit more. There are pipes. How many pipes?
We have 33,112 pipes. I admit that I have not counted all of those. That is the number that was on the contract written in 1929. We are actually keeping a spreadsheet. We have a very lengthy spreadsheet now that we're doing a count as we go along. We've already found a few discrepancies, a few more here and a few less there. So in a few years, hopefully, I'll be able to give you an exact number. But 33,112 is the count for now.
And of them, there are wooden pipes. Many of them are wooden pipes. Tell us about the sorts of sound that a wooden pipe makes, and what is the range of size among these wooden pipes?
Well, we are one of only two pipe organs in the world that have a stop that goes all the way down to 64 feet in length.
So when you say stop, define stop for us.
A stop is a set of pipes. Pipes only play at one pitch. So if you look at most organ keyboards have 61 notes. So if you had a stop, you would actually have 61 pipes, one pipe for each key on the keyboard. And then, of course, the organist can turn those stops on and off using either tabs or draw knobs to activate those stops. Originally, pipe organs, you just sat down and played, and you actually had no way to manipulate what sounds were playing. And so the stop was originally intended hundreds of years ago to silence sounds. And so that's where the name stop came from.
Got it. So one of these wooden pipes, is it the Dalzian?
The Dalzian, that's
okay.
Right.
Mm-hmm. It's 64 feet.
64 feet in length.
So compare that to somebody who's listening. 64 feet equals visually.
Visually, it's actually hard to see it because so much of the organ literally had to be built around it. Sonically, it speaks at 8 hertz per second, which is really below the point of human hearing. So it's almost
kind of like a rumble.
It's kind of like a helicopter flying over.
Yeah.
One of my organ builder friends said it was kind of like a tuned earthquake, which I think is really an appropriate description for it. But of course, the length of the pipe determines the pitch. So the longer the pipe, the lower the pitch, the shorter the pipe, the higher the pitch. Think tuba versus piccolo. So the longest pipe is 64 feet in length. The shortest pipe has a speaking length of less than a quarter of an inch.
Hmm. So, and these pipes were likely constructed of old growth sugar pine?
That's
my understanding?
Yes, that's primarily what most of the pipes are made out of. Pipes can be made out of lots of different materials. Pipes can be made out of wood, out of metal. We use zinc, brass, copper, tin, lead, all sorts of different metals to get different sounds. The woods also create different sounds because different woods have different densities. We have some pipes that are made out of cherry, actually, oak. But of course, that is a more expensive wood and not as easily to obtain in the massive quantities of lumber they needed in 1929. Mm-hmm. So sugar pine.
I guess that old growth sugar pine is not something that's being used.
It's not something that we can even get anymore, which is part of the reason that trying to put an insurance value or some type of value on the instrument is so difficult, because the natural resources simply don't exist anymore to try to reconstruct it if we wanted to today.
If you change the wood, do you change the sound?
You could, yes, yes. The different types of wood will create a different timbre and a different sound.
All right, what a little bit more on pipes before we move on. Describe the reeds.
Okay, there are two basic types of pipes in an organ. You have flue pipes, which are really just a glorified whistle. There are no moving parts. Reed pipes, we can take reeds and actually manipulate the sound. The reeds are actually made out of brass. But we can manipulate that buzzing sound that comes from a reed and make it sound like a clarinet or an oboe, all sorts of brass and woodwind instruments. Unlike an orchestral reed, which typically would be made out of bamboo or wood, that would break down far too quickly for our uses. So our reeds are actually made of brass.
And among your reeds, you have something called the Grand Ophicleide?
The Grand Ophicleide. It is the loudest organ stop in the world. The Guinness Book of World Records recorded it back in the 1930s and estimated, well, clocked it at 138 decibels.
Which is?
Louder than a fighter jet,
okay.
To put that in perspective.
So, when this organ is playing at its fullest, well, it has been likened to the Sonic Mount Rushmore, I think was a nickname for it.
Yes.
But, you know, it's obviously got a huge sound, but there's also nuance.
There is. There's an incredible level of subtlety. When I first came on board in August of 2015, only about 25% of the organ was playing, and most of that was loud.
Just loud.
I'm an organist. I'm certainly not a concert organist, but I'm an organist. And to sit down and play it and try to find subtle sounds and softer sounds was difficult. Now that we have restored the left stage chamber, as we call it, which constitutes about 25% of the instrument, that has so much color and beauty and subtlety in it that we've been lacking for so long, and we're still discovering different sounds and combinations every single day.
You're smiling as you say this.
I love it.
What brought you to this organ?
Well, I built pipe organs in North Carolina. I worked for a company called Cornell Zimmer Organ Builders. Through that, I got involved with the Wanamaker organ right here in Philadelphia and would come up several times a year to volunteer time to work on the organ. And then I actually, 2014... was the first time that I heard the Atlantic City organ. Several friends and I were here working in Philadelphia and decided to run down to the shore and hear the instrument. And then a year later, the job opened up, and I thought, well, you know, I'll see what happens.
There's always a little competition between the Wanamaker organ and the Mid-Merlotion Atlantic City.
Well, that's really kind of how the largest pipe organ in the world came to be.
Yeah.
Because, of course, there's always sort of been a famous Atlantic City-Philadelphia rivalry. The Wanamaker organ was largely completed by 1929, and we began construction in 1929. The whole project was spearheaded by a senator, Emerson Richards, and he was both a state senator by trade, but also just an incredible organist and brilliant mind. He knew a lot of the best and brightest minds in organ building, and he convinced the city of Atlantic City that in order to fill a room the size of Boardwalk Hall, which at that time could seat more than 40,000 people, he convinced them that they would need 150 symphony players every time they wanted music in the building. And it would be cheaper in the long run to build a pipe organ at great expense one time, but then you only had to employ one musician. Now, whether the accountants would tell us today that that was a successful argument, we'll never know. But he was able to convince them to build the largest pipe organ in the world. And, of course, to one up Philadelphia one more time.
People come from all over the world to see this Mid-Merloche organ. I remember back when I was there 7 years ago talking to tourists right at Boardwalk Hall, and they were just, they were starstruck. Does this instrument get the same attention and love from Americans in general? Is there an awareness that this instrument is at Boardwalk Hall?
I tell people that a lot of times it's really Atlantic City's best-kept secret.
Yeah.
Because for so many years, it lurked silently behind the walls.
And it was deteriorating.
Just simply not playing it causes deterioration. Pipe organs, like most musical instruments, really need to be played and need to be exercised in order for them to function at their best. So for many years, it sat silently behind the walls, and it's really hard to create interest in something that you can't easily see, and if you can't hear it, it becomes even more difficult. I actually find that the instrument is probably better known outside of the United States than here at home.
That was the sense that I got.
Yes, and so we're trying to change that. We have daily concerts Monday through Friday during the summer, from Memorial Day through Labor Day.
Free concerts?
Free concerts, mm-hmm. Yep, every Monday through Friday at noon. All year round, we have concerts on Wednesdays, and then we also offer a behind-the-scenes tour from 10 o'clock to 12 o'clock every Wednesday.
And let's go behind the scenes. There are walkways, there are skinny ladders, literally this thing just kind of, this organ goes from floor to ceiling.
There are more than 150 tons of pipe organ related equipment all the way from the basement all the way up to the attic. Yeah. The blowers are all located in the basement level. The pipes themselves generally are on the second floor to the fourth floor. If you go in Boardwalk Hall, you'll see two very large grills to the left and right of the stage. 56% of the pipes are located behind those two large grills.
And you can see a little something.
You can, especially when the lights are on. But even with the lights off, you can still see a little glint of reflection back in
of
there.
Of what's back there,
But anywhere you see the decorative grill work in Boardwalk Hall, there are pipes hidden behind those walls.
So tell us, we only have a few minutes left. Where are you with the restoration now? What are you working on, and how much does it cost?
Well, we're estimating the entire restoration to take about $16 million. Mm-hmm. We are about $4 million into that now. We are a nonprofit organization, so we are tasked not only with fixing the instrument, but also raising the money to do so. The Wincote Foundation out of Philadelphia has been very beneficial to us and has given us a number of grants in order to help with that. The building is actually owned and run by the Casino Reinvestment Development Authority. They have given us a $1 million matching grant. We had a three-year span, and I'm very proud to say that we actually were able to raise our $1 million in less than the 3 years. That's not to say that folks shouldn't still give. We do have a couple other matching grants in place as well. Yeah. But the fundraising is going well, and we're on steady progress.
Go ahead. I'm
sorry. Of the 53% that's playing, I'd say probably about 30% of it is completely restored. The remainder of it is still running on its original components from 1929, which is a remarmable lifespan. So we're very careful with those and try to take good care of them.
So when do you think you're going to have this completely restored so people can get the full...
It's effect. Sort of a moving target. Of course, everything depends on money. But a 5 to 10 year time frame is not out of the question. Mm. We're slowly moving our way around the room. There are 8 chambers around the room. We have 2 of them up and playing. We're working on a third right now. And we're just going our way around the room and restoring it as quickly as we can, but as best we can. I want everything to work well and work for a long time.
I remember meeting a volunteer named Buddy years ago when I was out there.
Yes, Buddy Grover.
Buddy Grover, and he was in the back, and he had, I think it was 80 sandpaper, 80 grit sandpaper, something like that, and just working on a brace, one of the braces. So there's so much intricate work that has to take place. And what struck me was the volunteers just seemed to be loving what they did.
We have an incredible number of volunteers.
A reverence for
yes,
it. Yeah.
Absolutely. We have 5 on staff. Myself and 2 others are full time, and then I have 2 part time. But then we also have a lot of volunteers who come in, some of them several days a week. Yeah. And I tell people if they know which end of the screwdriver to hold, that I've got a job for them, I can find something for them to do.
So Nathan, when all is said and done, do you have a piece picked out for when this is, you can say we're at 100% and this is the first one?
My ultimate goal would actually not necessarily be a solo organ piece. I'd actually love to hear it in concert with a mass choir or with orchestra.
Really?
That is my dream, to have a full symphony orchestra on stage with the organ and just...
And what sort of a piece would go with a full symphony orchestra? Well, can you pull something out of the hat?
Mahler or any one of the organ concerti out there, I think, would just be a stunning, stunning way to bring that to the public.
And that's going to happen, you feel?
I absolutely hope so. I'm going to make it happen one way or the other.
So when you sit down to play this organ, and I should just, we only have like a minute left, but there are 3 sections, I guess. There's the front, there's the left, there's the right, to somebody who's sitting down to play the organ. Mm-hmm. How do you manage all those sections?
I tell people that the organist has to both be keyboardist. They have to play the keys and the feet, but they also have to be the conductor as well. They have to tell which voices to play at what time. So it's a complete body experience. You're using both hands, both feet. It's really incredible.
And again, when you sit down to play this, what do you feel?
I am one of the lucky ones. We have 24-hour access to the building, so I can go in late at night when nobody else is listening, and I can just enjoy. And sometimes I have to make myself do that. Sometimes I get so caught up in the work that I forget to go and listen. Right. So that's one of the joys.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time, but we're going to close on By the Beautiful Sea.
By the Beautiful Sea, played again by Scott Briner.
Scott Briner.
He's one of our wonderful organists, so please come out to Boardwalk Hall and hear the instrument live.
Yeah, and if you want more information, it's boardwalkorgans.org.
BoardwalkOrgans.org. Yes, ma'am.
All right. Nathan Bryson, what a pleasure.
Thank you.
Keep us posted.
I certainly will.
Nathan Bryson is curator for the Historic Organ Restoration Committee, and we're talking about the Midmerloche organ in Atlantic City's Boardwalk Hall. Don't forget to follow us on social media. Check out our podcasts. Head to whyy.org/radiotimes. Our engineer today has been Charlie Kyer. Our producers, Debbie Bilder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. As always, thanks for listening to Radio Times.